We are indeed this evening appreciative of your presence into this place of assembly, that we might be able now to turn the thoughts and meditations of our hearts and minds away from those things that are in the world, that we might center them upon God and the revelation that he has given, and then in the process of doing that, that we might try to learn some things that will help us in the development of our everyday lives. Indeed, we do have some that are visiting with us this evening, and many of these ones are familiar friends to those of us who worship here, and we're just glad that you've come and are with us again tonight. There may be some that some of us are not as familiar with as others. There are a couple here this evening that have influenced my life in a great number of ways through quite a few years, especially Sister Polly Stotler, who is with us tonight. She was a part of the church at Barberton, Ohio, when we moved there, and worked there 11 years, and she was substantially influential in always encouraging and trying to do things that were right. And the fact, Mike, that she made the best chocolate cake with chocolate icing on it was just a sideline. But nonetheless, she is responsible, Cherie says, for some of this. Cherie would leave town, and Polly would always make sure that I didn't go without dessert. And I appreciate that. But I appreciate the love she has for the truth and some hard times that she's gone through and her faith in the Lord. And Sister Doris Roberson is here this evening. And Doris and her family have been mainstays in the work there in recent years. And we've loved them very much and have a great affinity toward Doris's daughter and son-in-law, Steve and Stephanie Nivens, and their son Andrew. Our boys, we thought for a while, might have to be surgically separated from Andrew when we moved down here. They spent a good deal of time together, and there was always just a closeness that was there in regard to the things of God, and we have a great love for them, and they're passing through on their way to go to Tennessee, and it's good to see them and have them with us tonight. Whoever you are that may be visiting with us, we're glad you're here. We would encourage you to do what we do now, and that is to take your Bible and open it up that we might study together. And if you'll open over to beginning in the 21st chapter of the book of Acts, we want to just kind of relate some events to lead up to where we want to study from this evening. You know, as you think about the life of the Apostle Paul and the pages of the New Testament, one of the things that you realize is that a great deal of the time that you see Paul in the New Testament, insofar as you're thinking about him with a variety of different letters is concerned, centers around the fact that he had been in prison for the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And you remember that his, at least first imprisonment, came about as he was returning from his third journey of preaching. And when he returns, as is characteristic of Paul, he has a rather large entourage of people with him, a greater entourage this time maybe than normal, because as he has journeyed through some of these churches that he had planted or that he had established or that he was watering, he went through with the message that there were poor saints that needed the help and the assistance of brethren. And as a result of this, these various churches were selecting messengers from among their own number, and they were collecting funds, and then these ones were journeying with Paul back to Jerusalem. They were trying to get there during the days of the feast, that they might be able to meet the needs of as many brethren as quickly as they possibly can, so that others of their brethren would not have to suffer physical distresses as a result of circumstances beyond their ability to control. And Paul, indeed, probably could have been the messenger himself for most of these churches. After all, they had great confidence in him, and they knew that he would certainly see to the proper disbursement of those funds, and yet that they might provide things honest in the sight of all men, he encouraged them rather to look among themselves and to select their own messengers and allow them to be the ones who would carry those funds back to Jerusalem with him and to those saints that were there. And so they did. And when they arrive, why, they begin to try to deal with those situations. And the wisdom of that was further enhanced, you know, because these men would all go back home. And when they got back home, one of the things that would happen would be that they would report the circumstances and the events that had transpired in the place where they had been, and whether there was any greater need, there might be compassion likewise manifested by the brethren that would cause them to again see about the needs of fellow saints. And as a result of this, Paul now is in Jerusalem. There are some distressing circumstances that arise, and yet it's not surprising to him. You remember as he returns on this third journey that it seems just everywhere he stops that there is some message that is being given as to his future imprisonment and even death. And for example, here in the 21st chapter, beginning in verse 10, and you could read on down through about verse 14, that Paul is in Caesarea. He is at the house of Philip, the evangelist. This is the same fellow who in Acts chapter 8 had preached in Samaria and then had gone and converted the Ethiopian eunuch. And you remember that he, after the conversion of the eunuch, was caught away and the eunuch saw him no more. And ultimately now we find him here at Caesarea. And a prophet by the name of Agabus comes from Judea. And he prophesies using visual aids. You know, he takes the belt or the garment of Paul and binds himself and says, whoever owns this is going to be bound like this in Jerusalem. And everybody recognizes the significance of this. And they encourage Paul to the best of their ability not to go up into Jerusalem. They see him as more useful being free. They see him needed for the church. And so they try to persuade him to allow the rest of them to go on and complete the mission that is before them and to turn around, as it were, and go back out into the field and continue to work in the kingdom of the Lord elsewhere in the proclamation of truth. And he says, why do you mean to weep and to break my heart? He says, I don't count my life dear unto myself. My purpose is set before me. I'm going to successfully complete the course of my ministry. And I'm not ready just to be bound. I'm ready even to die, if necessary, for the Lord in Jerusalem. When the brethren saw his resolute determination, they determined that the will of the Lord be done. You recall then that he goes on into the city. And when he gets into Jerusalem, indeed, as Acts chapter 21, verses 28 through 31, declares why he is taken as a prisoner. In verse 28, they find him coming out of the temple, and they cry out, men of Israel, help. This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere, against the people and the law in this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple, and hath polluted this holy place. For they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. And all the city was moved, and the people ran together, and they took Paul and drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. And as they went about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. Paul was now taken, and they are ready, his own countrymen, to put him to death. But there happens to be, by virtue of the kind of nation that Israel is, a fortress that the Romans have had built in this area, overlooking the temple area particularly, because of the emotional upheaval and the trouble that always seems to center there in trying to overthrow their rule, that they see very quickly what's happening, and a group of soldiers are dispatched. And they separate these things, and when they can't make sense out of them, they decide that they do what most do, you know, pass the buck. And so they bring him up to the chief captain, and we're going to let him sort all of this out. And you remember in chapter 22 that Paul asked for an opportunity to speak to these folks who've been following along behind, and he gets that permission. And they listen to him while he relates the story of his life, particularly his conversion. And they listen very well until he mentions the fact that the Lord had said that he was going to be sent to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. And as soon as he says Gentiles, that reminds them that they'd made the charge against him, that he'd taken a Gentile into the temple and polluted it, and another uproar breaks out. They throw dust into the air, and they rend their garments, and they scream, this guy doesn't deserve to live, away with him. And the chief captain, you can imagine his concern. He doesn't know what's going on. And as we would say, he decides the best way to get to the bottom of this matter is beat the truth out of this man. So he prepares him for a whipping. And Paul, as they do that, exercises one of the few times in his life a right that he constantly could have used even as a Christian. And that is the right of Roman citizenship not to be beaten in this manner for at least any reason that he didn't have a right to be. And as a result of this, when it was determined that he was a Roman citizen, the proceedings stopped, and now the chief captain has got to try to understand what's going on, but in a more civil setting. And so in chapter 23, you've got that civil kind of setting now that comes, and the Jewish Sanhedrin comes. You remember the ruling body of the nation of Israel? It's comprised of both Pharisees and Sadducees, and they come in to try to sort out just what the problem is here. And when they get down to it, Paul looks at the group and he talks about the fact that, well, in verse 6, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and of the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. And that was truth, wasn't it? Because the resurrection of Jesus was the very foundation of New Testament Christianity. It was the message that Paul preached everywhere he went. You can't read the book of Acts without seeing that the fundamental teaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ constantly and continually centered around the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. For after all, if he was not raised from the dead, he wasn't who he claimed to be. And if he wasn't who he claimed to be, then all of the things that were being done in his name were for naught. And so he says that it's because of the resurrection of the dead that I'm called in question. And what he does is he just, as this aisle divides this two sets of seats, he divided that assembly. The Pharisees, without thinking about what they were doing, jumped in and said, they're jumping on a fellow Pharisee. And they jumped up to defend him. And the Sadducees, it just turned them even the more against him, because it was against one of the very tenets of their doctrine. They didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. And now all of a sudden they've got an uproar going on here in a civil setting, and Paul's not done much at all except say just a few words. And so the chief captain still doesn't know what to do. And so he gets the situation calmed down, and everybody scattered out. And you remember then 40 fellows decide, we're going to have to take this matter into our own hands. If we can't get civil government to get rid of this guy, we'll do it ourselves. And 40 of them took a vow they wouldn't eat or drink until Paul was dead. And the plot was learned by Paul's nephew, who brought it to Paul, who sent him to the chief captain, who decided, something's going on here that's greater than I am, and I don't know what it is, and I don't want to fool with it anymore. And so what he decides to do is to send him to the higher-ups, and he sends him with a rather significant number of soldiers back down to Caesarea. The number of people that he sends to guard Paul shows he took very seriously the threat that these 40 men had determined, and the concern that he had about the kind of emotional upheaval that he'd been seeing here when Paul was brought to him, and now in a civil kind of a setting, just trying to find what accusation they'd make against this man, he decides to take no chances, and Paul was moved back to Caesarea from whence we began, where the prophecy was made. And at the same time, the chief captain has passed the buck to a higher up to decide what to do with him. And you remember that while he is here, that again, the Jewish council appears in the 24th chapter at Caesarea, while Felix is the governor. And they come in and they, you know, begin in their natural kind of way of paying homage to such a noble fellow before whom they would argue their case. But I want you to look at their charges. Verse 5. We have found this man a pestilent fellow, a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law, but y'all got involved in it. In other words, this is really not a matter for Rome and Roman civil government to deal with. Hand this guy over to us. It's a matter of Jewish religious law, Jewish tradition, and you let us get our hands on him, and we'll take care of him, and you won't have to worry about it. But Felix knows that things have gone too far for that kind of a situation to take place. I mean, basically what they've said about Paul is he's a pest. I mean, he's like the plague or a pestilence. He's not good for folks. And not only that, but he's a heretic among the Jews, a mover of sedition, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He's profaned our most holy place. You want an uproar on your hands? You want to a fight that's going to maybe jeopardize your whole garrison down there in Jerusalem. If you don't let us take care of this guy, it's going to destroy that whole community down there. And everybody that's your friend down there, their blood's going to be on your head. You see the kind of implications they draw? And you know, it's rather interesting when Paul gets to make a defense, he basically says, the only thing I did was go to Jerusalem for the purpose of worship. The only thing I did was I brought some alms back to my nation. I was being kind and charitable. Look at the way they talk about me. They paint me as a black-hearted buzzard. But I am a fellow who is here in concern for those who are my fellow countrymen. And I've come to do nothing more than just to worship. And he says, it's the hope of Israel that I have in me, and I worship according to the things that have been written before in the law and the prophets. And in verse 13, he says, neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. You know, it's one thing to make a lot of accusations. It's another thing to have proof for it. And that's exactly what he says. They've accused me of many things, but there is no proof for those things. And so, again, by the time they get done, why, there just isn't any way that this fella can figure it out. But he knows one thing, he just can't turn him over to this bunch of Jews. He's not about to do that. And he kind of likes Paul. And so he even listens to him preach. And you remember, it literally scares this fella to death, the message he hears. But that doesn't seem to interfere with what he thinks about the man. He continues to allow him some liberty and some freedom, and he continues to keep him confined, basically, as a prisoner. But here he is, still confined, and 2 years later, when the rule was about to change, lo and behold, Paul's still a prisoner. And basically, Luke is suggesting to us he shouldn't have been. The Felix has been keeping him thinking that the brethren would offer money for Paul's release from jail, and he could just go ahead and slip that in his pocket. That says what you've got is an innocent man here jailed. And the only thing he was going to try to do was to make some kind of personal advantage out of this situation. When you have Festus coming in, can you imagine being elected into a position or appointed to a position like this and inheriting a prisoner, and to start looking through your responsibilities and find out this guy doesn't even have any charges made against him? I mean, you're holding a guy that nobody can tell you why you're holding him. Taxes are paying for his support. You're feeding this fella. You're sheltering this fella. You're protecting this fella. You've got a soldier attached to this guy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, and you got no reason why you got him. I mean, if the higher-ups decide to come down and say, what's going on here, you're in a hard spot. And so he decides he's going to figure out just what's going on here. And you remember that the way he decides to do it is to just have Paul taken back to Jerusalem and sorted out up there. And Paul knows that that can't be, and so he makes his appeal to Caesar, another right of Roman citizenship. And when that was done, that was it. Nothing else could be accomplished. But it does produce one new problem. And that new problem is when you send a prisoner who's appealed his case to the emperor, you better have a charge to send with him. And he still doesn't have one. So what he does is he calls King Agrippa in, and he says, you know about the nation of Israel. You understand the way their mind works. You understand the way these people think. You understand something about their law. I got a fella here I don't know what to do with. I do know this. He's appealed to Caesar, and to Caesar he's got to go. Just looking at the matter, I really think he probably is innocent and ought to have been set free, but I inherited him and he made this appeal and now we're stuck with it. And so, listen to him and tell me what I can write about him. And I've said all of that so I can read one verse. In the 25th chapter and verse 26, he says, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord. Wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and especially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. I mean, here he's really got a problem. He says, I've got this man, and I don't have anything to write about him, but he's got to go to the emperor, listen to him, and tell me what charge to make against him. Let me ask you something. If that had been you instead of Paul, could he have said the same thing? Could he have said about you, I have no certain thing to write about you? Because your life was just as pure and innocent. Your interest was in nothing more than in the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That there wasn't any civil matter or even religious matter wherein they might be able to have accusation against you. They've had 2+ years of looking at the life of this man, of calling in whatever witnesses they wanted to call in. They've listened to the high priest, and they've listened to the Sanhedrin, and they've listened to a lawyer by the name of Tertullian. They've listened to a host of people make all kind of wild statements and accusations about this man. But every time they ran him down, they couldn't find any proof. And now he's got to go to Rome, and we've got to have some charge to send with him. It leads me to say this. You know, sometimes in my life I've been asked to write some kind of letter of commendation or recommendation in regard to a variety of different things for a variety of different people. Of some people, it is pretty easy to write about because they are very similar to the Apostle Paul in the fact that there are many commendable things in regard to their relationship to Christ that could be said about them. There have been some others that I have struggled with, frankly, through the years. And I decided at some points that the best that I could sometimes say about some is that when they left us, they were faithful insofar as their attendance was concerned. In other words, if you count on them for anything other than that, you're counting on something more than we got while they were with us. But that's about all. And you know, whenever you try to look at somebody trying to write something about your life, like this man was trying to write something about Paul's life, what could be said about you? Could it be said about you that here is one who is sincerely devoted to Jesus Christ? Here is one who's genuine. Here is one that's real. Here is one in whom there is no hypocrisy. Here is one in whom there is no guile. Here is one that's not counterfeit, but rather is the genuine article. And they are devoted. That is, they've taken hold well. They are committed deeply in their commitment to the Lord. They recognized that when they obeyed the gospel, there was more to their life than just simply getting wet. That they realized that they had formed a covenant relationship to God, and it extended to them many wonderful privileges and blessings, but at the same time, certain duties and obligations that they were going to have to discharge, and they did so and do so willingly and voluntarily and gratefully. Would that characterize you, that kind of statement? You see, somebody who is sincerely devoted to Jesus Christ is somebody who is going to apply themselves to some purpose. They're going to use their time and their energy and maybe their resources to the accomplishment of the things that will declare to others that they are sincerely devoted to Jesus Christ. It's going to be seen in things even as simple as their attendance. They're going to be faithfully and regularly found in the assemblies of the saints. And again, it's not going to be that spirit that we kind of talked about this morning that hopefully our children don't see in us. And that is that we kind of just drag ourselves into an assembly like this and we're just thrilled to death when it's over with because we can finally get out of here because we put in our time for the Lord, as it were, for this week. And now we can go out and do what we want to do with the rest of our time and with the rest of the people we want to really be with for the course of our life and the way that we spend our days. When we come into assemblies like this, are we sincerely devoted to Jesus Christ? Have you made preparation to be in a worship assembly today? If you don't get anything out of a worship assembly, inevitably I generally find it's because we put very little into the preparation for that assembly itself. We kind of come in and sit down and say, okay, teacher, preacher, song leader, fellow at the Lord's table, prayer, whatever it is, reach out here and zap me. Make me sit up and take notice. Entertain me. You reach out there and get my attention. I've done the only thing that I've got to do. I've brought my weary body in here and plopped it down so they can count me and say that I'm one of those numbers over there on the board. Or are we sincerely devoted to Jesus? Where we've taken some time to prepare ourselves and our minds, so that when we come in, we are equipped to the accomplishment of the things that the Lord, and not man, has appointed for us to do. When we come into Bible classes, how many times do we feel like they're dry and disinteresting and they're just the most boring things that have ever been? Let me tell you, take some time to read and study the material that you're going to contemplate and talk about. Get you some time to where you're looking at text and context. Look up some of those words that maybe aren't very familiar to you, or that you don't even know their meaning anyway. Find out what they mean. Anticipate. What is it that the author is trying to say here? What point is he making? And how can that point be illustrated in the society in which we live today? And participate in that discussion. I'll just tell you what. You'll find that all of a sudden, assembling with the saints will take on a little different view if you'll do that than if you just come in and expect somebody else to be the one who's got the magic to just kind of turn us on, like turning on a light switch. Those who are sincerely devoted to Jesus Christ, even in something as simple as our coming into the assemblies to worship God, are going to be doing the best we can to equip and prepare ourselves to get the most out of what God has appointed for us to do. You see, what this says is that this is the kind of person who does not treat New Testament Christianity like some kind of road to travel on. That they travel on it just as long as it's going their way. But if it ever diverges off in a direction they're not really willing to go, or they don't want to go, they go where they want to rather than follow the course that New Testament truth will lead. Isn't that about what you might say of Demas in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 9 and 10? Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed thence. Here was a fellow that you can read about in other New Testament letters, whose name could have stood just in your memory with the same kind of comforting ideals as Timothy and Titus and Luke and Barnabas. He was a companion of Paul. He was his hands and his feet. He was his eyes and his ears and his mouth in places that Paul couldn't get to, either because he was imprisoned or because his workload wouldn't allow him to be in some other places where he needed to be. But he could send some of these others to go out and to accomplish those things for him, and Demas was one of those fellows. But for some reason or another, when the roads diverged out there, Demas took the one that was more conducive to the world. He took the one that he would rather have traveled. There was some conflict that arose, and he decided not to follow anymore the path of New Testament Christianity. Would that have to be said about you? Or could it be said of you that you were sincerely devoted to Jesus Christ? Could it be said about you that here is one that makes steady progress as a child of God? Do you make year-by-year progress in your growth and your maturity as a Christian? You know, we chart that kind of growth so often where our kids are concerned. I don't know what it is, but we seem to be in a time of the year when most of us who are parents believe there must be something about the sun and the heat and the humidity or the something that between the end of May and the end of August causes kids to grow. Have you ever noticed how that the same jeans that your kids can wear when school was out, they can't wear when school starts the next year because they're high water pants? I mean, they don't even get anywhere near their ankles. And you haven't realized they've grown at all. It doesn't seem like it, but they did. Well, we chart that kind of growth. You go to the doctor, and what's the very first thing he tells you to do? He says, step up on the scales, please. And then what's the next thing he does? The next thing he does is he says, do you realize you've gained 4 pounds since you were in here to see me last? Or whatever it is. He's charting your growth. It tells him something. Are you charting steady growth as a Christian? God expects that out of us. In the 5th chapter of the book of Hebrews, beginning in the 11th verse, Paul says, of whom we have many things to say and hard to be uttered, seeing ye are dull of hearing. Paul says, I've got many things to say, but he says, I'm having a hard time saying them. You know, I never can see Paul was a man at a loss for words, can you? Not where the gospel is concerned. But he says, my difficulty in saying the many things I have to say to you is this, you're not equipped to hear them. You've just not grown and developed. I've got to try to grope out here to find things that I can get down on the level that you need to hear and understand so that you can get motivated or get busy growing and developing so you can get involved in some of these other things that need to be involved with. For when for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and have become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. For everyone that useth milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But strong meat belongeth to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. What's he saying? He's saying there's a time all of us in the sight of God have a right to be a babe. Every one of us. But not forever. There reaches a time and a point where we're expected to grow, where we're expected to mature, where we're expected to develop. Let me ask you, if the Lord were writing about you, could he write about you that here is one of my people who has made steady progress in growth, in maturity, year by year by year? Be honest with yourself. You can answer that question. You can't answer it for anybody else. You may look at somebody else and say you think they ought to be growing faster than they're growing, that they ought to be more mature than they are. But really, the only one you can answer that question for is you yourself. Could that be said of you? And finally, could it be said of you that here is one who will do their part in bearing our burdens? In the sixth chapter of the book of Galatians, in verse 2, the writer says, bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. But let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone, and not in another. For every man shall bear his own burden. We've looked at this passage, I guess, through the years, and one of the things that we've recognized is the point that I want you to see, to be reminded of again tonight. And that is, here you have the responsibility of burden bearing. And notice that there are two different concepts to that. In chapter 6 and verse 2, there is the responsibility of bear one another's burdens. The word burden here is the word baros, and it carries the idea of a load. It means something that's heavy, and it carries the idea of just exactly what happens, fellas, when your wife is changing the furniture around. She's able to move most of it, but finally she comes to the couch, or she comes to a desk, or she comes to something that's too heavy, and she says, would you give me a hand with this? She's not able to do that on her own. Now she needs help in moving that thing. That's the idea that he's talking about here. There are some burdens in life that are born by a person, but while it may be that they have to be the one to endure a great deal of it, there are some things that you and I can do that will assist them. It may be I can't take everything off of you. It may be somebody else can't remove all of the difficulties that you're facing. But somehow or another, there are some things that can be done that assist in the process of that load that has to be borne at that particular part. That's why in Romans 12 and verse 15, Paul can say, weep with those that weep and rejoice with those that rejoice. It's the very illustration of what he's talking about there in verse 2. Again, maybe we can see it by looking back in an instance in the life of Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4, just a minute. You remember here that he is remarking in regard to his first defense. Evidently, he defended himself before the emperor more than one time. And Paul was a man, as we've already talked about, who often was found in the company of others when he was doing the things that he was doing. Even when he was in prison, generally he had a group of others around him, and that's the reason why, as you close a number of New Testament letters, you find him commenting on who is with him and which ones he sent to certain places, and maybe even which one had been basically doing the actual writing as he dictated the letter. And then maybe Paul would take the pen himself and say something like, "See how large a letter I've written with mine own hand," or something like this, to indicate that he himself had had a personal hand in the writing of it. But sometimes it was written by, as we would say, a secretary, one of these other fellows. But when his first defense came, notice he says in verse 16, "At my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. I pray God that it might not be laid to their charge." You know, I figure that was a pretty low ebb in the life of the apostle. Here was a time when he really needed some of these others. Oh, if you'll look at the latter portion here of what he writes in 2 Timothy, you'll see that no doubt he himself was partly responsible for some of that. Partly because he'd sent some of them, like he always did, off to do various things that needed to be done that he was not free to go about and see about himself. Timothy he had sent. Titus he had left in Crete. There are others that have been commissioned by him to do various things. But when it came time, he says there were some. And notice he doesn't name them. And notice he doesn't badmouth them. Notice he doesn't come down on them. He just simply says, they could have been here, but they didn't. And I only pray that God does not hold them responsible for their failure to encourage. He says, rather, the Lord stood with me. He said this was a responsibility that I had to deal with basically on my own. It would have been nice when I left to go before the emperor, if I'd left several brethren who had told me, "We're with you. We'll stand with you. We support you. Teach the truth. Stay with God." And when I came back to have said, regardless of what he says, he really doesn't hold your life in his hands. Life is in the hand of God. And that the decision that he may make, even if it is detrimental to you in this life, will never affect the final decision that God will make in the after one. Or maybe even somebody who might stand there and say, "Paul, I love you. And I stand where you stand. I may not be able to fill your shoes, but I tell you what I'll do. I'll stand as solidly for the truth as you do if your life's taken." You know, going in or coming from, the emperor of the world at that time, who wasn't a very stable fellow to start with emotionally, and psychologically, could have been a great boost to the apostle. But he said, "All men forsook me." Paul says, "Bear one another's burdens." There are some times when it may be nothing more than just your presence. It may be the fact that what you have done, it's not so much what you say as the fact that you listen. And you may let somebody else pour out their heart and their distress or their concern or their anxiety or whatever, and just kind of get it off their chest. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. On the other hand, he wants us to understand in verse 5 that every man should bear his own burden. In the King James, you've got the same translation, but you don't have the same word. This is the word forshawn. And it means pack, kind of like a backpack. And that's what it carries. It's the whole duty of man's responsibility before God for which he is individually responsible. And what he's saying here is there are some things that you and only you are responsible for. The salvation of your soul, you and you alone are responsible for. Nobody can believe for you or repent or confess or be baptized for you. If that's ever done, that you might have the remission of your sins, you and you alone must do it. The same thing is so in regard to duties. The duties that God places upon us as a Christian. They are the things that can only be done by us. Listen, I can go to gospel meetings, but I don't represent, and never have and never will, the Knollwood Church or any other. I go as a Christian, that's all. I go to the hospital. Or I go into homes sometimes and visit with folks. I don't go as the Knollwood Church, and I don't go for a single solitary one of you that's out there. I go because that's my duty. That's my responsibility as a Christian. We've got this idea that we can pay the preacher to do our work. And when he goes and he's representing the church at Knollwood, when he goes off to a meeting somewhere, or he's representing the church when he goes into the hospital room, I just tell you, I don't know where you got that idea, but folks, you didn't get it from here. When I'm doing that, I'm doing what Galatians 6 and verse 5 says. I've got a burden of duty and responsibility in regard to these things, like all of us do. And we've got some responsibilities there, and we've got to discharge them. We've got some teaching responsibilities. We've got to discharge them. There are some folks that I have taught. There are some folks in whom that teaching is took. There are some who have rejected the message of the gospel. My responsibility was discharged when I did what I was responsible to do. And so is yours. Standing in the judgments that way. Romans 14 and verse 12. I can't stand there for you. And furthermore, the Lord's not going to pull me aside and let me make judgments on the rest of you. He'll take care of that himself without any help from me or you either. These are individual matters. We stand responsible to bear ourselves before the Lord. How are you doing in bearing your burden of obedience to the gospel? If you were to die tonight and someone were to write something about you, what would they say? Of Paul, he said, I have no certain thing to write about him. There's nothing condemnatory. There's no law that's been violated. There is no charge that can be sustained against this man. There are accusations, but there's no proof. Let's live in that guileless way. Let's live in that pure way, that innocent way. That when others see that about us, they see people sincerely devoted to Christ. They see a people who are knit together, who are concerned about one another, who are busy about the duties and the responsibilities that God has placed upon them as Christians, and are making steady progress as Christians as days come and go in their lives. And when we do that, we will exalt him who died to redeem us. Have you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ? If we could do it for you, we would have already done it long ago. But it's a duty that only you can do, only you can perform. Won't you tonight believe Jesus to be the Christ, the Son of God? And as Jesus said, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Won't you do that tonight? If you've done that and not lived as you should have, won't you indeed turn from whatever it is and renounce it? Renew your covenant relationship with the Lord. Won't you show yourself to be one who is committed to Christ, the King, who is enthroned as the ruler of your life? The opportunity is yours now. What do you do with it? That's the question we ask while we stand and sing.
629.